Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net.
Hannah, I'm so excited to see if you can connect this evening's wine with a movie we saw this week. So here you go.
Avalon Cab. Well, I'm guessing it either has to... Oh, Cab!
See how they did that?
A taxi driver. Very clever. I like that.
So we're going to talk about, five, six films this week. And two of them are solo, because you saw two more than I did.
I did.
And one of them, I'm not going to tell you which one yet, because I'm going to keep the audience's suspense. It's very rare 4 stars from me, but it's not going to be the one we lead off with, is the animated feature, The Nut Job 2, Nutty by Nature, probably the worst title that kids won't understand. We get it, but
it's a terrible
title.
Right.
I'm shocked The Nut Job 2 exists because I remember The Nut Job, and it was not good the first time around, and I didn't think it made that much money, but it's back, Hannah. What do you think about The Nut Job 2, Nutty by Nature?
Yeah, the first one, I guess, was in 2014, and somehow I think I missed it. And so I did not have a basis of comparison. To me, it's just one of those sort of safe animated films for kids. It's the kind of movie that if you don't have a kid just begging to see this, there's absolutely no reason to go.
It's like a Despicable Me 3. You know, there's no reason to see it if you're anything other than 4. And spoiler alert, I asked my 4-year-old, who sat through the whole thing, didn't squirm, watched the whole thing, and he said, "Dada, I don't like this movie." And he gave it a big old thumbs down.
Yeah, I saw that. But, you know, and if the 4-year-old gives it a thumbs down, then I really don't know who exactly this is for. But I do know people who like Despicable Me 3, and we both thought that one was really weak. So it's possible that if people are just sort of cruising through these animated movies for kids throughout the summer months, that they're going to go to this one, whether we think it's good or not. But it's definitely not one that sort of works on multiple levels. It's no Zootopia, that's for sure.
Well, my biggest problem with this is it's not funny. Like, I don't recall jokes. I'm assuming there's some visual puns, maybe some one-liners. It's about some animals in a park, mostly squirrels, some rats, some moles, but, you know, the leaders are the squirrels. Surly is the lead squirrel, voiced by Will Arnett. Katherine Heigl shows up as the somewhat love interest. The first time around, it was about finding food, finding nuts. Well, they solve that. So at the beginning, they own a nut store, pretty much. All the nuts you could ever eat. That explodes. And then the big thing is a developer, the mayor, a very corrupt mayor, his license plate says embezzling. He wants to tear the park down, make it an amusement park on the cheap, make some money. He's voiced by Bobby Moynihan. It's the animals, the park animals versus the corrupt mayor and some construction guys. And there are themes of, you know, animals, we belong in the park, not in the nut store. Come back to where you belong.
And also just we animals have to all stick together if we're going to defeat the bad guys.
Teamwork.
So, like, the rats, the city rats have to join in with the wild animals in the park.
That was a weird one. So, Jackie Chan, he's featured prominently on the poster. He's in the mouse. Hardly in the film. And it's shoved in. It's forced in. The city mice don't need to be here. But, you know, none of this needs to be here. I don't know why I'm analyzing this so much. It's terrible. It's a terrible movie.
It's not a terrible movie. It's just a blah movie.
It's worse than Storks.
No. But Storks is fine. Storks is okay.
It's worse than The Secret Life of Pets. And we thought that one was really mean.
But that one was, you know, also just kind of...
It's worse than Rock Dog.
I don't know. Maybe I'd put it sort of on par with Rock Dog. I didn't think it was bad. It just was nothing that I would go out of my way to ever try and see or to send anyone else to. And yeah, the Jackie Chan role of the cute, but don't call him cute, city mouse or city rat. Very underdeveloped character. Like, you could just tell that I think half of that character was left on the cutting room floor because it didn't really connect very well. And so it was kind of a waste. I think it was just to throw another cute animal with big eyes and big sad looking eyes who was going to prove that you don't mess with him.
The entire film's a waste. I don't really want to talk about it anymore just because no one needs to go see this thing.
Yeah, they probably will, but they don't need to.
We did not see the film that's probably going to win the box office this weekend. That's The new Annabelle, it's a sequel to a spinoff. So we're talking about the Conjuring franchise, where there are two Conjuring films. Very good. I'm a big fan of the Conjuring franchise.
Me too.
And they spun it off into an evil doll like Chucky, but it's Annabelle. I didn't see the first one. I didn't see the second one. Any thoughts on Annabelle?
Yeah, I didn't see the first one. I didn't see the second one. I really am a huge fan of The Conjuring and The Conjuring 2 because it's a genre that I typically don't like.
But you
I
hate
like
horror
those.
Films.
I generally hate horror films, but this one has an 81% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Ooh la la.
Annabelle. And I'm like, did they even screen it for us?
Not for us.
Yeah, so usually it bodes poorly when a film doesn't really screen for the critics, but this one is that rare breed where it'll probably do well, and it's actually trending fairly well with the people who want to see it.
Horror films do well their first week out.
Except go
Wish
figure.
Wishpond didn't.
Oh yeah, well that didn't deserve to. But so it'll be interesting to see what happens with it, but I'm not going to go track this one down, and there's too much other really good stuff out there coming out this week to see instead.
So we do more in our lives than watch films than watch movies. I know it's weird. We watch 6 or 7 movies a week. How do you have time? We have full-time day jobs, both of us. And sometimes my job makes me tired. And last night, I was so tired, I texted Hannah, I'm not going. I'm not getting on the train. I'm not going downtown to sit through a very long movie and then crawl back on the train home. I'm just going to stay home. So Hannah's the only one of us who saw The Glass Castle. And I know nothing about this. I know it's based off a memoir. I think Naomi Watts is in it. It's all I know. So take it away on The Glass Castle.
Yeah, I mean, this is going to be a big one for the chick flick drama crowd. And this one, in terms of Rotten Tomatoes, has a 50% or 51%. And I can see exactly why. It's going to be divided right down the middle. Half the people are going to really like it and half are not. And so I kind of feel that people who read the book that it's based on will probably be okay with it. It's based on the best-selling book by this woman, Jeanette Walls, who is a magazine writer who wrote this memoir about her very bizarre, dysfunctional upbringing and coming to terms with her past and then sort of figuring out what it meant to her present and her future. And it stars Brie Larson, who won an Oscar for Room. And so she's very good. But then there's also a person who plays Jeanette as a young child. And that girl was also very good. Her name is Ella Anderson, and she was very impressive. But then the real star probably of this film is Woody Harrelson, who plays the very dysfunctional alcoholic father, who in many ways is kind of brilliant, but has dragged this family around for years, just doesn't pay taxes or anything and doesn't believe in the system. And so they basically are squatters from place to place, and they believe that like being homeless is a lifestyle choice. And so
it's a terrible Captain Fantastic.
It is. And so that was sort of the comparison a lot of people were making, was to Captain Fantastic. And was this movie potentially romanticizing too much that kind of life that really involved a lot of very irresponsible and in some cases dangerous parenting? Naomi Watts plays the mom, and she's like this eccentric artist who, just sort of whatever dad wants to do with their lives, she basically goes along with. They have 4 kids, and so the primary, you watch, it's intercutting, and it is too long. It's over 2 hours, and it's you always feel like, okay, how long is this going to go on? Because it goes back and forth, intercutting between present day with Jeanette being engaged to this sort of stuck up, straight laced financial advisor, and trying to figure out her present relationship with her parents and her siblings. But then it keeps going back to like throughout her childhood and what got them to this point and who her character is at its core. And so, I think that intercutting, it just got a little old, and so I think the performances are all incredibly good, but it is going to be one where some people are just going to feel that they just don't like what this family endured and what the father character put his kids through, even though in the end you kind of got the sense that he was doing the best that he could. He just had a kind of some potential mental illness going on and maybe had endured some stuff himself as a kid that he was still working through. So it's a good romantic, not really romantic, it's a good chick flick literary drama. And in very much the same way that a lot of people, some people liked and other people did not like Light Between the Oceans. I know you hated it. So I think you probably would have disliked The Glass Castle. But it's PG-13, so even though it's got adult themes, it's not quite as heavy as it might otherwise have been. It has some light moments. And for people who read the books, I think that they might really like this movie. And I'll be curious to find out the people who were huge fans of the book, what they think of this movie. And, you know, Jeanette Walls herself has praised the movie and says that it's like, it's her truth. And so if she feels that it's being portrayed accurately by Hollywood enough, then it's like, who are we to judge whether or not it's a worthy portrayal of her life?
You know who we are to judge? Stephen King said he really liked The Dark Tower, but I'm judging. So when you say memoir and Woody Harrelson as the drunk, abusive father...
He's not really abusive. Or the alcoholic.
Not setting a very good example. I think the prize winner of Defiance, Ohio, a Julianne Moore film from the early 2000s, where Woody Harrelson was in a memoir playing the drunk, but in that case, quite emotionally verbal abusive father. Very similar. It also reminds me of Running with Scissors, if you remember that memoir a little bit.
Yeah, so but Woody Harrelson's performance is really good in this movie, and you do start to occasionally, this movie would give you the feels, Charlie.
Now, we'll really get to the feels later. Those films are coming up.
This one would have given you a little bit. You'd have to be...
No, I'm not too sad that I missed this
film. To not get some sense of the emotional drama towards the end. It's really, I would say, about three quarters of the way through, maybe even a little further. That's when... people were getting a little misty-eyed, I think, in the theater. And, you know, it's... and here's... Christian Hammacher did like it. So how unusual is it for...
You two don't agree on movies.
We don't agree, but we were actually chatting about a lot of these things. And we kind of agreed on a few that are really surprising. We kind of agreed on Book of Henry that other people were slamming. And so I just... I think this one it's set in the 1980s. It's like 89. I think it opens, it starts, it's set in New York in 1989. And again, it's based on a true story. And a bunch of these movies that we are talking about this week, it's amazing how many movies right now are based on true events. And I like those kinds of films.
Well, thank you for the transition. I really appreciate it. Inspired by actual events, that's what it says, inspired by actual events, our next film is Wind River. And it's written and directed by Taylor Sheridan. If you know his name, you've probably seen his movies. He wrote Sicario. He wrote Hell or High Water, which is my favorite film from that year. Mm-hmm. I think it was just last year. And he wrote Wind River. And for the first time, he stepped behind the camera and he took charge of the vision. He directed it. Wind River is a 4-star film. It is now in my top 3 films of the year. Talking about giving you the feels... It is I normally wouldn't care for this genre. It's a murder mystery.
It's a chilling. Your feels are chilly.
It's an action. It is. It's like up your spine kind of feels. It's action, sporadic, violent action. But it's almost like a police procedural murder mystery, which draws you into the setting. Sheridan is known for his place. Sicario was the U.S.-Mexican border and the overwhelming violence wrought by the drug trade. Tunnels and everything. Hell or High Water. Financially depressed, middle of nowhere, West Texas. Wind River stands for Wind River Indian Reservation in Wyoming. Middle of nowhere, dead of winter, Wyoming. We see the opening shot, very wide, very panoramic. You see that a lot in these nature pictures. He's pulled back, look at the whole landscape shot, and you see a girl running, and she ain't running, you know, to lose a couple pounds. She's running for her life. She's barefoot in the snow, and she's not going to make it. And she doesn't, and the man who finds her is Corey, Jeremy Renner, now one of my leading actors for the year. This Jeremy Renner is not really known for acting. He's known as Hawkeye.
Hawkeye, and the Avengers, he's known for
you know, the Hurt Locker.
Yeah.
But he's not really known for as being an actor's actor. And here, he gets his due. He gets a lot of time to maybe get teary-eyed, make some heavy speeches. And I want to know, Hannah, did this almost seems like a film that would turn you off a little bit. Do you agree with me, though, that the Wind River is sublime?
I don't know if I'd call it sublime, but it was very engaging. It was a very intense thriller. I did like it. Again, a movie with really good performances. This whole week felt like it was more of a award season kind of week. That these films that we're seeing, some of them are just powerful and excellent performances all around and just gripping kind of stories. And so it was like, wow, this is only early August. What is it with these films? But I did like Hell or High Water. So that could be one of the factors that Taylor Sheridan just manages to put together a film that usually does not fall into my wheelhouse, but does it well enough that I really did. I did like it. And it's just very haunting. It gets kind of, it does get... somewhat shockingly violent near, you know, probably near the end. So you're sort of chugging along thinking that, oh, this is a really, this is an interesting drama. And it also stars Elizabeth Olsen as like this rookie FBI agent who is brought to this Indian reservation to help solve this murder. And she enlists the help of Corey, the tracker. And together they are really determined, each for their own reasons, to unravel the mystery of this girl's death. And so their relationship is very interesting. You know, there's like that hint, like, are they going to try and build some sort of romance into this? But then it's kind of nice that they really don't overdo that, that these characters are just really solidly written. There were a few lines that I thought were a little cheesy, a little over the top about with some of the things that Jeremy Renner's character delivers. And so I thought some of that felt a little bit forced. You know, he says, I know you're looking for clues, but you're missing all the signs. And I was like, what does that mean exactly? So I don't know. I just thought that sometimes it strayed a little bit into the cheesy dialogue, but overall I agree that this is just a really good choice for somebody who's in the mood for just a good chilling sort of thriller with some heart too.
Some of those lines you're talking about, those kind of cheesy out there lines, they're establishing, I think, a strong theme in the film, which is man versus nature. The residents of the Indian reservations, as they say over and over, we don't live here, we survive here. It's very hard to survive here. And one of those is, this isn't the land of backup. This is the land of you're on your own. You know, the residents here are very insular. They're inward looking. They distrust outsiders. And along comes this really young FBI agent, blonde from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. So do you think they're automatically going to open up to her? No. And she recognizes that and says, please, Corey, who works for he's a government guy. Yeah, he works for the Fish and Wildlife Administration as a very rare, he's a hunter. He's a sniper. He, you know, takes care of the wolf problem and the lion problem. And he says, I need you to help me solve this murder. And he's got his own agenda. The murder reminds him of a bad thing that happened in the past. So is he helping to solve the current murder? Or is he using it as means to his own ends? Someone mentioned that this would make an interesting television series where the FBI agent enlists the help of the local tracker sniper to solve weekly crimes.
Yeah, I think it would work for about 4 episodes and then it would, well, except also I don't know who'd be left standing at the end, but I think it makes this point that the Indian reservation is a very bleak place and how they're just sort of left. There's all these jurisdictional issues in play, and it's based on true events. And so when you realize that, it makes it all the more powerful to watch.
Well, it's an expose of contemporary reservation life. At one point, it acknowledges stereotypes. There are substance abuse problems on the reservation. There's nothing to do. Their future is so bleak that they fall into patterns and cycles of substance abuse, but it shatters stereotypes as well. There are doctors and lawyers and businessmen who are Native American who live on reservations. They do that as well. And I love the score. It's very bleak. It's very lonely and haunting. It's by Nick Cave. This movie is just intense.
Well, and Gil Birmingham is in it as
Hell or High Water Man.
Yeah, so he plays a cop yet again in this one.
No. Gil Birmingham's the father.
Oh, he was the father.
The cop was Graham Greene.
The cop was Graham Greene, who I also really liked in this. Oh, that's right. So Gil Birmingham was the dad. He was very good and affecting. And, it's not a fun watch for the summer, but it's a good one.
Absolutely. Take the time to go find this film. It'll just knock your socks off. All right, our final three films. Normally, this is like the documentary portion of the show, but we're going to go foreign. None of them are in French.
Yay!
In fact, the first one we're going to talk about is in Russian/Estonian. And yeah, it's finally getting distribution here. It looks like it was made in 2015. Mm-hmm. It was nominated for a Best Foreign Film Golden Globe from Germany, Finland, Estonia. It's called The Fencer. And talking about another movie that gave me the feels, it shouldn't. It's sentimental. It's deliberately emotional, and it's you know the plot. The teacher riles up and motivates the underdogs, and then the team goes and tries to accomplish against the big city kids who, are expected to win. Think Stand and Deliver. Think Coach Carter.
Think Queen of Katwe.
Hoosiers, Queen of Katwe. And it's about fencing. But at the what makes it worth the watch, worth trying to find it, is the time and the place it is set is so specific and so unique. That's what made this movie okay. I can see why I got the nomination, but well, I don't really see that. It's not that good.
Oh,
but
see, I did. I actually was surprised that we didn't hear more about it. It made the short list for possibly making it in.
That's because it was up against
film.
L.
Yeah,
and
but I'll tell you, I enjoyed
Son of Saul. Maybe.
Yeah, but I enjoyed watching this one way more than like a Son of Saul or an L. So, what's fascinating about it is it's set in, like, early 1950s, and basically this, and it, again, based on a true story. You find out that this is really based on something that actually happened, and that makes it even all the more intriguing. And so you've got this this guy who shows up in Estonia at this school in some rural village of Estonia. And he's basically fled from Leningrad, and you don't really know what his backstory is, but he's obviously on the run from, like, the secret police, and he ends up getting this job in this school, and he starts a sports club or fencing club, and the principal, of course, is like, we don't need fencing here. and he immediately tries to undermine this program, and then, of course, in the end, it's like these kids really take to fencing. They take to this teacher because they have nothing else. It's like such a bleak existence for them. Their fathers have basically all been carted off by Soviet police. It sort of is taking place at the height of the Soviet occupation of Estonia. And it essentially what happens is the guy has to make this choice about whether or not he's going to let these kids go to a tournament in Leningrad, in which he would put himself in jeopardy by showing up in Leningrad, or disappoint these kids. And so it's great to sort of see how that conflict plays out. And I think if you don't know this guy, Nellis,
Endel Nellis.
He apparently is quite famous in fencing circles, and this club that he started in Estonia back in the early 1950s is still going strong today. And so it's just, if you've never heard of Endel Nellis before, I think it's worth kind of learning his story. And, the director acknowledged that it's part fiction, that it's based on true events, but that they took some dramatic license. But it's a very moving story. There's two really good kids in it. The one who plays Jan, who's sort of the this boy who whose grandfather is has been a fencer in the past, and is trying to keep his grandson engaged in the sport club because his father is gone. And then there's this other girl, Marta, who from the poster you would think she was, you kind of are expecting and waiting for her to have her moment in this film, and apparently she's really the only trained actress of the kids in this film. And you can see that she's really, really good to watch. And it's really, it's Estonian actors for the most part. And I just thought, this was just really good. And I'm sad that it hasn't gotten, that it didn't get better distribution. It's sort of like rolling out in just a couple of theaters each week over the next, you know, month. And so I really encourage people who do like a good, sort of overcoming the odd sports drama to check and see if it's playing anywhere near them in the future, The Fencer.
Well, The Fencer really works if you know your history and your international relations. There was no Estonia in 1953. It was the Estonian Soviet Socialist Republic of the Soviet Union. So when the principal says, we don't do fencing here, he's not really saying that because he doesn't want, you know, he doesn't like swords or epis or foils. He's saying, we're the proletariat. We are a commune. We're the collective. We produce the vegetables and fruit for the big cities like Leningrad. When he always says like Leningrad because he doesn't like the big cities. And fencing is elitist. It's the old systems from the czars. You don't bring that to rule Estonia. So Endel is really sticking his neck out. You know, at first, he's not a teacher. He doesn't know how to teach these kids, but he breaks through the barrier through sport, through fencing, his only love. There's a love interest in this movie, and that's a kind of a sour point because it is so underdeveloped. She only exists to, like, you know, plead with him and talk about, say, you should.
It's sweet. It adds that little, it adds that dreaded
sweet
factor.
She's so one-dimensional. That part doesn't work.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fine. It just injects a little bit of romance into this otherwise bleak existence.
I'm fine that he had a romance, but give her a line.
Yeah, but it's like there wasn't much for her to do other than just kind of be there and support him. I'm not sure how they really could have built out her character.
No, that's the problem. That's all she was. She was just there to be there and support him.
Yeah.
That doesn't work.
Yeah, but part of it is you're trying to get this sense that here's this guy who is sort of on the run, who expected to just be running his entire life and did not expect to build any sort of bonds in this village with anyone, let alone with these kids.
Why is she the only young 20s person in all of Estonia?
Just imagine that. I mean, you know, as soon as you see her look at him in the school, she's like some other teacher, I guess, and you know immediately where that story is going. And so, I mean, there's sure it's kind of formulaic and predictable.
Everyone already knows the plot. If they've ever seen a teacher teach underdogs, you know the plot.
But that's it's a feel good film.
It is, and I have a heart of coal, yeah. And
yes,
I had feels.
You do, and you had feels, so that's great. And the fact that I could feel that way about a foreign film.
This should not be in your alley.
It should not be in my alley, but I do believe this is one of those rare arty flicks with a definite mainstream appeal if you go and you can find it.
Another one that should be nowhere near in your wheelhouse and the one you wanted to watch is in Korean. It's called A Taxi Driver. And what do you know? It's about A Taxi Driver, but it's set in 1980 in South Korea. I lived for a year in South Korea. I'd heard of it. I'd heard of the Gwangju Uprising. And I knew that South Korea used to be a dictatorship, and there was a military coup back in there somewhere, and the president was assassinated, but I didn't really delve into it. I didn't really know. 1980 was a long time ago for me. I had other things on my mind. But the Gwangju Uprising was university students and young citizens tired of dictatorship, and they wanted democracy, so they went in the streets. And the military, junta at the time, who took over, violently oppressed it, quashed it, guns, murders, and no one knew about it. Because Gwangju is in the south. This is out of the way. No internet, no cell phones, no foreigners. Gwangju it's not Seoul. There aren't foreigners hanging out down there. So the only reason word got out is because there was a German reporter there who just bopped over from Tokyo because he heard about something. Something was going on. So this is an over 2-hour film about the Gwangju uprising through the eyes of a foreign journalist, but more importantly through his kind of non-political turned aware cab driver.
Yeah, I was so shocked. I really was not aware of the Gwangju Uprising. And I still, even after watching this film, I'm like, why was this going on? I still didn't quite grasp why it was only in this one province that there was just this horrible bloodshed.
The whole country did protest, but they stopped when the military said stop, but Gwangju didn't.
Yeah. So it's It is good. I mean, it really, to me, I wanted to see it because I just read, again, based on a true story. Mm. And it was, you know, this guy with the German news agency is just determined. A lot of war correspondents, they really do thrive on running into where the battles are and telling the stories that might not otherwise get out. And so he took this responsibility very seriously with being able to capture footage of the killings and the uprisings, because the news that was coming out was basically towing the line from the military that, oh, you know, it was these student demonstrators that were causing all this mayhem and that only a few people had really been killed. But when the taxi driver is able to take this German reporter from Seoul into Gwangju, and you discover that that there was all this other stuff going on, it becomes very important to both of them that that the story get out and that they somehow manage to salvage that footage and show the world what was really going on. And the taxi driver, you know, what made this movie kind of interesting for me, and I really just sort of stuck with it, even though it was very long, was that it took a lot of turns that I was not expecting. And when this film opens, you're just meeting this sort of this widower, single dad who's just trying to get by, and you know, he just needs constantly in need of money to pay for his daughter's care, and so he really co-opts another cab driver's fare to take on this customer and drive him into Gwangju without really knowing what he was getting himself into. And he was very naive and really believed everything that that he was hearing until he really had to witness a lot of it for himself to suddenly make that turn and to become sort of a reluctant hero. And so I just really enjoyed it. It was, you know, it's in Korean with English subtitles and a little bit of English in there too, because the German guy, I'm sure he probably spoke German and not English in reality. But, you know, it was just another one of those small stories that you just didn't really necessarily know about, or some people didn't really remember after, you know, 1980. And so I like to see that it gets its due, and another action drama with heart. I found it really surprisingly effective.
Well, you mentioned both men want to get the footage out of Gwangju, back to Seoul, and beam it around the world. It took the cab driver a very long time to come around to that. In fact, it took him 2 hours of the 2 hours and 17 minutes to say, you know what, I think this is bad, and you're right, now I want to get this footage out. And it shows almost like the code of cab drivers in Korea. Like, you will never desert a fare. You will see it through to the end. And there are a few things that do not work for me. The end. It wants to make you cry. They get out of the fire zone where people are just getting mowed down by machine guns. And he stops the cab. And he looks in the rearview mirror and there's all this smoke and mayhem in the background. And that's the moment. It's like, all right, we want you to take stock. And you're like, all right, I see what you're doing here. And this is cloying. And then there's a chase scene, which is preposterous.
Yeah,
the most preposterous chase scene I've ever seen. I don't think they needed it. They could have just quietly driven back to Seoul and then wrapped up how they wrapped up. They didn't need that stupid chase scene.
Yeah, I wonder. And this is where it would be very interesting to maybe read the real information, this German reporter's memoirs, perhaps, about what actually took place back then. Because I think it's like, was there a real chase scene where the cab drivers, where all the cab drivers from Gwangju sort of got in the act to protect this cab driver who's trying to get back to Seoul with the reporter? And so my only thought is that maybe they inserted that in because it was very close to something that actually happened that did play a part in the guy getting out with this footage. So I'd be more forgiving if there were some sort of detail somewhere that made that a reality. If that was sort of just thrown in for dramatic effect, then I think it would have, then yes, I believe it was probably a bit of a waste.
I do not believe that ever happened. I think that's created on a PowerPoint somewhere. Someone had that idea. But, you know, if I had to compare these two, The Fencer and A Taxi Driver, I couldn't really pick a favorite. They're both just really delicious indie like foreign films that just come out of nowhere.
I agree.
Now, our last one I did not see, but it's peculiar. It's called Menashe.
Menashe.
And there's a reason, if you hear about it, people are talking about it, because what is so unique, Hannah, about Menashe?
That it's in Yiddish?
Whoa, because you don't. Can you name any other Yiddish film ever?
No, I believe it's been like 70 years or something, apparently, since there was a film in Yiddish. And, you know, if you know some Yiddish, it's sort of this weird hybrid of Hebrew, German, and English is what it, you know, what it kind of comprises. So you actually pick up little bits and pieces. Even through the subtitles, there are things that that I could sort of pick up on. And also it was filmed secretly inside this Hasidic community in Brooklyn, this ultra-Orthodox community. And so it's really based, again, largely on the real-life story.
It's like four in a row.
Of its Hasidic star, Menashe Lustig. And so I guess he plays himself, sort of. And he it's the story of this sort of hapless grocery clerk in this Hasidic community. And he wants to maintain custody after his son. So his wife had died a year before. And apparently there are these crazy traditions in this community where a kid cannot be raised in a home that does not have a mother in it. And so he essentially loses custody to an uncle, a very strict uncle who's married. And but as the 1 year anniversary of his wife's death is upon them, and they have this big memorial, an unveiling, as they would call it, with the headstone at her gravesite and a memorial service, then this Menashe's rabbi gives him permission to sort of have custody of his kid for a week and leading up to this memorial. And Menashe is trying to show the community and that strict uncle that that he can really take on this role and be the father, and he doesn't have to have a wife in order to take care of his kid. But it's you know, it's really another one of those ones for the Jewish arty crowd. So if you've already seen the ones we talked about, The Past Life, Women's Balcony, The Wedding Plan, this is basically yet another one for that. The people who would appreciated those films.
They are
films.
Getting a lot of films this year.
They are. And so, but it's about the father-son bonding and sort of revealing just those, the culture and traditions that that have basically forced this poor schlubby. Menashe is basically, he's like a schlubby mensch. And so he means well, but he also is sort of his own worst enemy. He screws up a lot. And so you are sort of left to wonder, is his son, who's, I don't know, maybe around like 10, 12, is he better off, with a strict uncle and living in with a family or living with his father? And so it kind of leaves some of that open, and, it's, you know, and Menashe is struggling to be a capable parent, but whether or not, he can really pull off the single father life is definitely left open to question. And it's a nice movie, but compared to those other two, after having seen The Fencer and A Taxi Driver this week, the third foreign film for me just didn't even come close. It was just a very slow, quiet kind of foreign film, whereas the others were way more affecting.
I opted not to watch this movie. I deliberately chose not to because I didn't like the subject matter. I don't want to watch a father lose custody of his child because it's going to be, I could see it already. Like, how dare they? Da, da, da. And then you'd be like, oh, Charlie, you just don't understand this community and
exactly.
their rules.
Exactly. I would have given you that same spiel.
And you said, you're the wrong audience. I'm like, no, but I am an audience. I'm an audience and I'm just nauseated by the fact, like, you know, he's a father who's not going to kill his child. He's going to raise the child.
But you're basing it on the synopsis of this storyline, which really is not what this movie is and where it takes you. And it was that same conversation we did have with A Wedding Plan where you were like, so, you know, where you just thought it was ridiculous what, you know, the roles that this woman was subjecting herself to. And I kept trying to explain, yes, but this is in line with with the traditions and the culture that she is very
And yes, I would be accused of cultural insensitivity because I'd end up saying, well, your culture is wrong. You're doing it wrong. Yeah. So instead of putting myself through that, I opted not to watch it.
It's a rather extremist perspective for sure. And yes, it's not for everyone, but it doesn't take any real hard line one way or another, I don't think. And so that's just sort of what makes it just kind of like just a film that's there.
Since he shot it on the sly and it's kind of based on him, I wonder if he got in trouble then. Did he break the rules and did he get kicked out or something?
I don't think he got kicked out, but I'm sure he did break some rules by filming this within this very private community.
Is he
going
to have to work double shifts at the grocery store now?
It's not for you and it's not for everybody and it's really for a small sliver. It will be appreciated by seriously the same group that probably if they liked Wedding Balcony or Women's Balcony and Wedding Plan.
I would love to watch a movie in Yiddish. I would because it's so unique. It just doesn't happen. But not touching it.
It's not that. I think you'd be a little surprised that it's not really what you're thinking it would be. So it would not have been as painful as you think. You still probably would not have liked it, but I don't think you would have found it as painful as you think.
Well, if it was not for the Nut Job 2, this would be a very strong week.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we let off of that just because it's going to make $1 billion because it's a kids movie and it's the widest release this week on like 4,000 screens. But ignoring the fact that the Nut Job 2, Nutty by Nature, exists.
And that Annabelle will probably do fairly well,
Annabelle will probably win the week, probably beat the Nut Job. But there are so many strong films where if you live in a large metropolitan area, you have a smorgasbord of choices this week, and I would urge you, implore you, ignore everything else and go see Wind River.
I think it's a toss-up between Wind River and The Glass Castle, depending on what you are really aiming for. Wind River is an R-rated, tougher watch crime drama thriller, and whereas The Glass Castle is more for your female literary crowd, probably, and is PG-13, is a little easier to watch and to tolerate. But then I think that the hardest ones to find are going to be A Taxi Driver.
Impossible.
Almost impossible to find. And The Fencer. And I just hope that people jot it down. And if they see some little blurb about it in their local paper, that they go, we should check that one out. Or just kind of put it in line for a potential rental someday if they ever become available as streaming, because they're fine to watch. You don't need to see them in a theater on a big screen, but they're worth watching.
You know, if I had a 12-13 year old, I would easily automatically take him her to see The Fencer. They would get so much more out of The Fencer than I don't remember The Fault in Our Stars or Everything. They would get life lessons and be a better person, think about the world in a different way.
And you'd learn
if they
a bit
saw
of,
The Fencer.
And you'd learn a bit of history.
You'd be the only kid in school who knows what it was like living under Stalin in 1953.
Right. That's right. But but both of those were ultimately very watchable, endearing foreign films with based on true stories that can't hurt to know about.
You know, if The Nut Job 2 was based on a true story, every film we talked about tonight would be based on a true story.
Yeah. If only The Nut Job. Who knows? Maybe Surly Squirrel was really somebody wrote that based on some squirrel in their backyard that was like, you know, breaking into the nut shop down the street. I don't know.
All right. Moral of this episode is go find a foreign film. And watch it this week.
It's rare that really. I would agree, but yes, in this case, in addition to the two that we talked about that are more mainstream, those two foreign films are very good.
You heard it here. Hannah wants you to watch more foreign films.
No. These two.
All right. Well, on behalf of the Cinema Clash, I'm Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Bookbell.
Thank you.
Take care.